Want flexibility? Take yoga. Want flexibility with your health insurance? Check out United Healthcare Insurance Plans. Underwritten by Golden Rule Insurance Company, they offer flexible, budget-friendly medical, dental, and vision coverage that may be right for you. More at uh1.com.
Tired of ads interfering with your favorite sports podcasts? Good news. Ad-free listening is available on Amazon Music for all the music plus top podcasts included with your Prime membership. Stay ahead of the game by downloading the Amazon Music app for free or go to amazon.com/sportsadfree. That's amazon.com/sportsadfree to catch up on the latest episodes without the ads.
Hello and welcome to the Game Podcast from The Times. I'm Natalie Sawyer.
And I'm Gregor Robertson. We're here with you twice a week throughout the season for all the best reaction and analysis from some of the best football writers in the business.
And joining us today, it is Matt Dickinson from The Times. Coming up, we'll discuss yet more problems for Maurizio Pochettino. But first, to the Etihad. Manchester City were beaten 2-0 by Wolves at home to leave them 8 points behind the leaders Liverpool in the title race after only 8 games. 2 Adama Traore goals in the final 10 minutes mean City have now dropped 5 points in their opening 4 home games of the season, having dropped just 3 in the whole of last season. So where did it all go wrong for City? Paul Hurst was there for The Times and joins us now. Paul, for all of City's millions that they have spent, injuries have caused them problems this season. They gave a full Premier League debut to João Cancelo, who cost £60 million from Juventus in the summer, still able to leave Bernardo Silva and Gabriel Jesus on the bench, but they were without other key players like Kevin De Bruyne and Leroy Sané. Is it as simple as to say that injuries were their downfall this weekend?
Yes, I think it is as easy to kind of boil it down to that. Principally because of the lack of Aimé Laporte or John Stones there. I think you look at Nicolas Otamendi, and a couple of years ago in the 17-18 season, he was in the Premier League team of the season. But that season he had Vincent Kompany alongside him, or Laporte or Stones. But he was alongside Fernandinho on Saturday, and as we know, Fernandinho is a central midfielder. He's not a defender. So once you make Otamendi the main man in defence, the senior guy, he's clearly exposed and he's not up to it. And I just thought positionally he was poor on Saturday, and he left Fernandinho doing most of the legwork. And I mean, it just looks so simple from Wolves. They could have been 3-0 up at half time. All they needed to do was just run at the centre backs and City just panicked. So, yes, they did miss De Bruyne a little bit creatively going forward, but certainly at the back, that's where they missed Laporte and Stones as well.
Matt, is this the first time we can question the strength and depth then of Manchester City?
Well, I certainly think at centre-half, people have been talked about that for a while, and obviously at holding midfield as well. Rodri came in to sort of give Fernandinho a much-needed break there. I guess they were over-dependent on him in that sitting role. But yeah, centre-half, it felt like a sort of injury accident waiting to happen a little bit in that position. I mean, I do think, it felt a little bit to me watching it like a sort of perfect storm, in the sense that, City had a few early chances, they don't grab those, and then as the game goes on, Wolves are probably, particularly with the pace of Traore, a better place than, as City will try and defend on their own halfway line. If there's one team and one player that's going to got the potential to expose them, then it's Traore's pace. So it felt like, to me, like 2 or 3, 4 things all combined. But, City being unusually ragged, unusually twitchy, certainly was a big part of that.
Gregor, obviously as a former defender, can you make a case for any of these defenders? And then maybe we're being a bit harsh on them, or not at all?
I'm struggling. The Otamendi's challenge for the first goal was really sort of... There's not really any defence for that, I don't think. I mean, I've probably made worse mistakes myself, undoubtedly, in fact. But, the golden rule there is stay on your feet and try and show the attacker down a channel, ideally away from goal. And he just completely made it so easy for Wolves to score there. I think the other thing is, Laporte obviously is the biggest loss, but even if, Stones hasn't been convincing either. So yes, it has been a kind of a big failure on Manchester City's part. but they don't really have an excuse because they have the funds, they have the money to make signings that they have to make, and that was really quite clear in the summer. And for whatever reason, they chose not to make an addition.
Paul, a lot has been spoken about Vincent Kompany, his retirement, and the fact that Manchester City haven't replaced him. It was, what, £15 million, the difference in the two asking prices, or the two prices both Manchester United and Manchester City were willing to pay. Do you think there are any gripes there from Pep Guardiola that City didn't stump up the cash?
Yes. If you talk to people close to Pep Guardiola, they'll tell you that he wasn't happy at all that they didn't sign a replacement for Kompany in the summer. And you can see why he'd be annoyed, because coming back to Otamendi, I know we've mentioned him a lot already, but he was considering leaving the club before Kompany announced his retirement, or announced that he was leaving City. So they were preparing for life after Otamendi. They weren't going to play him, and now all of a sudden he's the main man. And Maguire, as you say, £15 million was the difference. I know that's a lot of money to pay for a centre back, but as Gregor said, they've got the money. They needed a centre back a lot more. Then they needed a right back, which made Cancelo, he's a very good player, but I don't think they needed him as much as they needed a centre half, because going into the season with three centre halves is just it was a very, very dangerous move to make, and that's why Pep was annoyed that they didn't get Maguire over the line. It's just left City completely exposed, and we're only a fraction into the season.
It was interesting afterwards when Guardiola spoke about the loss. He said his team were nervous at home to Wolves. He said, "We started quite well, and after we conceded two situations in our build-up where it's impossible to defend, we got a little bit nervous." Matt, how can a team like Manchester City be nervous against Wolves?
Well, I think their standards are so high, aren't they? And I think when they either fail to start moving the ball around as they're accustomed, or they're prevented from doing that, and when a team, we saw how effectively and Wolves were defending at times with 11 men in the first half, and I guess just when you feel that there's a spark missing, when things are not going as slick as they're used to, they're suddenly out of a comfort zone's not probably the way to put it, because it's hard work to play as well as they do, but you could suddenly see little things stopped going for them that they might normally expect. They were sort of running into blocks of defenders, the odd chance, hitting the bar or flying wide, and even a team as comfortable as City can quickly feel as if things aren't clicking.
Mm. Paul, talking about the title race then, if we look back to this time last year, Liverpool and City played out that goalless draw to leave both of them level on 20 points. You had to, in fact, go until December, until City's first loss of that campaign. This season, they've already lost twice. The gap between them and Liverpool, as we've mentioned, is 8 points after only 8 games played. In fact, this is the biggest recorded lead for a team at the top of the table after 8 games. Are there concerns at City that it's not looking likely that they can defend their title again?
Well, Pep was insistent last night, as you'd expect him to be, that City can catch Liverpool up. He pointed to the fact that they were a considerable length behind Liverpool last season and still managed to catch them up and overtake them. But I just think this season it's going to be so much harder, because Liverpool seem to have got the bit between the teeth. They just keep winning matches. They're like a machine, aren't they? And City, as we were saying, don't have Laporte back until maybe January or February. And Stones, as Gregor said, hasn't been amazing when he's played either. So there's that frailty at the back. And with Sané out as well, they're missing an apple up front. So it'll be a lot harder for them to catch Liverpool this season.
Gregor? Do you think this is Liverpool's title then? It's early days, of course, but
yes,
the way things are working out right now.
It is, yeah. I really think that defensive sort of weaknesses could prove to be pretty decisive, actually, over the course of the season, because Laporte's not back until well into the new year. And Liverpool, I seem to say this almost every week, you still don't feel they've really hit top gear yet, Yeah. Salah's kind of been... He's been good, but not, if he dips slightly, then then Mane steps up and he's been exquisite this season. Firmino's been brilliant, but they've been poorer defensively, Liverpool, than we'd expect them to be after last season's sort of defensive record. So I think that's ominous. You know, Liverpool still have got top gear to find, and we're early in the season, but I think it's certainly theirs to lose at the moment.
We know, of course, Liverpool had a big lead over Manchester City last season. City were able to overtake them in the end. But after the international break, City travel to Crystal Palace. Liverpool head to old rivals Manchester United. For a City perspective, Matt, they really cannot afford any more slip-ups.
No, and I agree with Gregor. I think the scariest thing for them is that Liverpool, you know... I think there is, despite their winning run, more to come from them. I was reminding my sons this morning that when I'd put down Liverpool to win the title at the start of the season, they mocked me even more than they usually do. So maybe a little bit early for me to be getting my retaliation in, but I'm among my usually dreadful pre-season predictions, I'm feeling pretty comfortable about that.
We should spare a thought on Wolves, the victors at the weekend then at Manchester City. They were winless in their first five Premier League games and now unbeaten in three, winning their last two. This win is their 17th match of the campaign, which began back in July 25th. It now leaves them 4 points off a top four spot. It feels, Gregor, as though perhaps Wolves have finally adjusted to competing in Europe as well as their domestic matters that they're concentrating on.
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, we know the record of teams that play in Europa League is always a big dip in their league position the following season. So Wolves have obviously had a tough start, but they really seem to be back to the sort of the team of old, that really resolute defensive block with the back three. And the three midfielders in front of them and the wing-backs and Traore was, you know, it seems amazing. Somebody's getting a song out of him on a regular basis. He seems to be, he's electric to watch sometimes, and then other times you think he's kind of, you know, he runs the ball out of play or something. So that could be a new position for him. And so fast, the number of times Raheem Sterling tried to go past him and he just sort of turned on the afterburners and said, no chance. Certainly a big improvement for Wolves, but they needed it because it was a tough start to the season for them. And it's still, you know, the further they go in the Europa League, it catches up with you. It can catch up with you and the number of games becomes a problem. But it was an excellent performance.
It was. And Wolves' Raul Jimenez explains how they targeted City's weaknesses in that win. They say, we knew that City's a game that when they have the ball, they leave some spaces when they are attacking. We didn't have too much time to plan the game because last Thursday we were playing in Turkey and we had 2 days for rest. So it was just the things that we know, the things that we are good at doing, and we made it work well. How much credit then should Wolves be getting for this victory? Because we are focusing mainly on Manchester City and how poor they were, but how good were Wolves, Matt?
Yeah, I would say I think it was one of those days where you need a bit of luck to survive the early pressure, which, you know, they had a couple of chances that City could easily go in, but they defended doggedly. Especially considering the amount of games they've had, they looked organised, they looked like they had a plan, and then when you can, you know, as Gregor said, Traore sort of 1 minute he's being effective tracking back, and then next minute he's released for those counter attacks. I can't remember who described him as someone on the telly as like a learner driver at the wheel of a Ferrari for a while. You know, he has got that sort
Martin
of.
Martin Keown, I think.
Yeah, you know, he's got. You know, everyone knows he's got this extraordinary pace, but you're never quite sure what's going to happen at the end of it. And this time he kept his nerve superbly well.
He is exhilarating to watch sometimes. I mean, I remember watching him in the Championship as well when he was at Middlesbrough, and sometimes he's weaving in between players at ridiculous speed. And when you're there in person as well, it's kind of one of those where you're eye-widening moments. I've never seen anyone as quick in real life. And you know, when he raced through for the goals, there was no chance anyone was catching him.
And it's those thighs as well, as it's like sort of Zanetti type thigh. You know, yeah. You can see this the running power in him. I mean, it is electrifying. And I think it was a plan that worked.
Now, Newcastle have a new hero in Matty Longstaff, who capped an impressive Premier League debut with the winning goal to move the Magpies out of the relegation zone and heap more misery on Ole Gunnar Solskjaer and Manchester United. United's tally now of 9 points after 8 games is their lowest in Premier League history. Solskjaer said, "If you only walk on sunny days, you'll never get to where you want to go." And he is adamant things will slowly turn around. But, Matt, how much further can things sink at United?
Ooh, that's a big
question.
That
sounds ominous.
No, well, I've been pretty, I think, upfront that I've, shall we say, been a Solskjaer skeptic from
day one.
Yeah, well, I didn't know, but like a lot of us, we didn't know, and you had to look at the record, you had to look at the size of the job, you had to look at what he'd done, and putting the scale of the job, what was required, against his known achievements, experience, skill set, looked to me like something was seriously out of kilter.
That's another thing you got a bit of stick for as well.
I'm certainly not saying he's the only problem there, and I think the fact that Woodward has put his faith in him, he's put his faith in the vision that Solskjaer sold, he's put his faith in him to make already obviously some significant transfers and was planning to make more. My suspicion is that Woodward will be thinking, I don't want to sack him soon, because that doesn't just look like Solskjaer's failure, it looks like Woodward's pretty spectacularly as well. So I'm sure Woodward's instincts are to try and show faith and to try and back him. But it's, it gets hard. I mean, is there a team that's harder on the eye to watch in the entire league at the moment than Man United? I almost think that's as scary as the issue of points. Mm. And bearing in mind that they're on the same amount of points as Sheffield United, that's a pretty extraordinary thing to say. But I sat down to watch it yesterday, and after 20 minutes, you were just thinking, this is even more drab than I'd expected. Rashford clearly shouldn't be on the pitch at the moment. He's just physically, stroke mentally, not there. Clearly just not happy in himself. So, I'm already sort of scattering the problems around, but they're big and they're getting bigger. That's the worry if you're a Manchester United fan.
I think it's alarming before a ball's even kicked, when the team sheet arrives.
Yeah,
you look at it and you go, oh my, people are talking about McTominay as the kind of as the shining light of this team, and he's a fairly sort of
humdrum.
A hard-working player, but he's not, I hope he does well. He's Scottish as well. And Daniel James, who's just arrived from Swansea, is kind of their chief creative spark at the moment. And then you look around and, Ashley Young's wearing the captain's armband as well. Pereira is just non-existent. It really
Fred
is.
Yeah, doesn't offer anything.
Yeah, I mean, he was controlling the ball out of play and several times and just doesn't look like he should be on the pitch at all. It really is. It's like alarming to see that team at the moment. That's a Manchester United team. And people keep saying as well that, he needs two or three or four transfer windows. But people have been saying that for 2 years now, 3 years more. And so whoever is in charge of these of the recruitment and the transfer dealings in the transfer windows, that's your first problem. That's the first thing you've got to tackle. It doesn't matter who the manager is at the moment. I mean, it does to a degree if you were to put someone like Pep Guardiola in charge of that team, it would look very different, I'm sure. And Solskjaer, in any other circumstance, he wouldn't be manager of Manchester United. But the more sort of pressing problem, I think, is the structure of that football club and who is, it doesn't matter.
From top to bottom.
Yeah, and he deserves three transfer windows. It doesn't really matter because the transfer dealings have been absolutely catastrophic.
Well, people are making excuses in the sense that there were a lot of injuries for Manchester United. They were missing some key players. But, Matt, a club like United should still be able to cope, surely, if they're missing key players.
Well, exactly. And you see it's questions of partly of depth, but it's when you bring in a player like Fred, who you spent £50 million on, he's got to look like he is hungry for that chance. He's got to look like he knows the job. Instead, he just looked like a guy who wasn't just off his game, but completely, gone in terms of confidence. I mean, sometimes you know, it you just see a player who just almost wants, you wonder if he wants to be on the pitch because things are just, like Gregor said, the ball's bouncing off his shin. There was one, I can't remember, someone knocked a simple pass to him, it just rolled straight past his foot, and you saw him wait, you know, he's not an incompetent footballer, you know, he's not saying he'd justify 50 million quid, but he, you know, they bought him for a reason, and he's so far short of the standard because clearly his head is not in the right place, and that's the worry, is that they're sending, you know, sending him into midfield, big job, clearly just not in the right frame of mind to do that job. As I say, Rashford, who, you know, there's this way too big a burden on him that, you know, from the start of the season, they sell Lukaku, as we all know, and he starts the season, get us 25, 30 goals or else we're in trouble because no one else, you know, you got Greenwood coming through. He's a, you know, promising kid, but just a kid. So Rashford starts the season already with that expectation, you know, and bearing in mind that we're not even sure that he's a proper number nine. You know, he's got great ability, great pace, but as Gareth Southgate's discussed with us recently, he prefers to play him wide because he feels he's more comfortable wide at the moment of his development. So, you know, you've got Rashford, who's clearly sort of looks like the weight of the world is on his shoulders. So, yeah, they have got a few players to come back, Pogba and Martial and a few others, but I just think every single of their key players in key positions looks like they're troubled.
Yeah.
And the manager on the side looks like he's troubled and he looks like he's sort of aging in front of your eyes.
Well, he certainly does. And they may be 12th in the table, but the bigger reality is, of course, that they're only 2 points clear of the bottom three, Gregor. Is it conceivable then they could actually be fighting a relegation battle as opposed to fighting out for a European place this season, as is the norm?
I mean, it's not inconceivable, but I don't know. I think when they get a couple, I mean, I don't know. I really don't know. Pogba is, like Matt says, he doesn't really seem like he wants to be there that much, and he's the sort of the beacon of hope in terms of, he's the most talented footballer probably at the football club. Martial is a talented player, but he's not been without his sort of troubles at the club and his time at the club. Who else is coming back? Luke Shaw. He's not had an easy time of it either. No one has. So that's the players they're banking on improving their form. I think relegation battle is probably stretching it, but I think they certainly in this state they could possibly finish in the bottom half.
Well, we've talked about Manchester United then. Let's focus on Newcastle. Maybe the mood has temporarily been lifted there after all the gloom that has been going on at the club. At 19 years and 199 days, Matty Longstaff is the youngest player to score in his Premier League debut for Newcastle as he drilled home a lovely low finish to leave Manchester United 2 points above the bottom three, as we've mentioned. Longstaff was playing in midfield alongside the more well-known Longstaff at the club, his older brother Sean, and the pair have dominated the headlines. So, question is, have Newcastle discovered something special in the younger Longstaff? Let's ask the Times' Martin Hardy, who's written about the Longstaff family in The Game today. Martin, thank you for coming on. Let's just ask you then about Matty Longstaff. Just how special is he?
Their dad, David, is a 100 times capped Great British Ice Hockey International, and I've known David for 30 years, and I can't remember how many years ago now, it must have been 5 or 6 years. On a Sunday, we would have a beer in the sunshine, watching Time Out Cricket Club play. And Sean was playing for the first at 15 as a gangling, very fast bowler in the Bob Willis style. And the younger Matty would be buzzing around and would take my son off to play cricket. And I would always have a chat with Sean, and they're a lovely family, and they're a lovely pair of young lads. I would also have a chat with Sean and David and I, as we sat with our friend San Miguel. I said, Martin, you need to make sure you get on with the young one as well. So he has been regarded as a potential very good talent for quite a long time. But as for last night, I don't think it had sat, well, I spoke to David this morning. It's still not sank in with him what happened yesterday. I spoke to Michelle, the boys' mum. It hadn't sank in with her yesterday evening as well. It's a proper Roy of the Rovers story, that to make your home debut and to get that opportunity in front of the Gallagher end, which is where all Newcastle fans dream of scoring, and then to drill the ball into the bottom corner in the 72nd minute and to beat Manchester United. I'm not sure it gets much better than that. To paint a picture, I'm currently sat outside of Kirkley Park, which is the home of Wall's End Boys Club, where they've just unveiled a £600,000 new pitch through Premier League grants. And we've been chatting to Alan Shearer and Michael Carrick. Obviously, Michael Carrick's mood was more glum than Alan's. But both of them said, especially Alan Shearer said, what a joy for that young man. And the interview afterwards, Gary Neville has tweeted about the purity of what they brought. It was about football, and it was about a young lad coming and absolutely seizing his opportunity. And you mentioned earlier on before I came on there about the mood. Newcastle is one of the moodiest clubs in the country. And from being doom and gloom yesterday morning, it now appears very bright as two young lads make their way. Now, you mentioned there about Sean being the more experienced of the two. He's the veteran with, I think, about 15 Premier League games. And obviously now he's got his young brother with one beside them. And, you know, I'll be writing a piece for the Times tomorrow. But in that celebration when Matty charged towards the corner of the Gallagher end in the Millburn stand, it was quite a nice moment that's been missed by everybody, and that DeAndre Yedlin went to get a hold of Matty first, and big brother Sean arm-locked him out of the way, grabbed his brother first and buried his head in the back of Matty's neck, which is a lovely, lovely image.
Oh, it certainly is. And you know, talking about these two young Newcastle players who are born and bred, and this is all about, this is their life in Newcastle, being a player and a fan as well with the family. The supporters of Newcastle must absolutely love this story.
What was so refreshing was having no, I'm obviously biased, I've known the family for a long time, so I was quite emotional yesterday and may have been more enthusiastic towards somebody scoring a goal in the press box than he's supposed to be. But it's because you've known somebody for a long time. But then, and yes, as you said, that mood spread amongst Newcastle fans. You know, there was great delight last night. But beyond that, talking to other journalists and people from outside the area, just said that this is a really lovely story of a young player from that region, having been schooled in that club's academy, coming in, at, as you said, at 19 years old, and just grabbing the game by the scruff of the neck. There's lots of nice elements to it. Steve Bruce said, you know, in the modern game, Steve Bruce said this, in the modern game, you can play the simple pass, everybody can look quite short. This is your debut against Man United. And the first real time he got the ball, he looked and I could see what he was going to try and do. And he pinged a 35-yard pass to his right to find Yedlin. And Steve Bruce said afterwards, I looked and thought, is he going to do it? And he did it and nailed it. And he said, aye, aye, we've got something here. Now, that great courage. And on Friday, to get into the technical elements in Newcastle's side and the problems that Steve Bruce feels he's been having, he wants the team to be more mobile. He wants more sprints. He wants more energy. He wants more running. It was a big call yesterday to put two lads in, two young brothers in the heart of the midfield. And yes, it's not the Manchester United that we know, but it's still a live Premier League game against one of the biggest clubs in the world. But, and perhaps there was a uniqueness in the story that when you think back to the Nevilles, they were on the other side, on the alternative side of the pitch to each other generally at Man United. Most brothers don't sit next to each other in the same position and do the job together. So it feels like it might briefly have altered the course of Newcastle's season, because if they had a loss, you would have had 2 weeks of introspection and does Steve Bruce deserve the job, etc. But it's calmed Newcastle down a bit. And the two lads themselves last night went up to see the parents in the executive box from where they've been celebrating, and got in the car and went home, and you know, life is normal for them, back to the family, well, back to the mum's home, and they just have to kind of ride this storm of publicity for a few days, because obviously everybody's very interested in them now. We remain as who they've always been, which is young lads that went out for a family meal on Friday night, sat there in their hoodies, they're not flash. A dad missed, who is still playing ice hockey and is the Whitley Bay Warriors coach, missed the game last night to go and watch them play. The three of them always go to hockey, so, and sometimes the young lads go into the dressing room, that's Sean and Matty, and get kept in check by the ice hockey player. So, you know, Michael Carrick certainly made reference to it in the conversation we've just had about this is just a start and how hungry are you for more. Well, these two lads have a very good chance because they are so very grounded from the start.
And just finally, Martin, on this story and this situation at Newcastle, we know when Steve Bruce came in, there were a lot of anti-Steve Bruce with regards to that appointment. But does a win like this obviously buy him time, but does it prove that maybe he is actually the right man to turn things around at Newcastle? It's the first time he has beaten Manchester United as a manager. And this time last year, Newcastle were in the relegation zone with 2 points from eight games, whereas this time around, they've got 8 points from their first eight games.
Yeah, it's a complicated situation. There was a great deal of belief in Rafa Benitez because Benitez was a Champions League winning manager and a Premier League winning manager. And Benitez is a nod back to perhaps 15 years ago when Newcastle were perceived to be a much bigger club than they are now. So once he had gone, there was a fear that Newcastle go back to what they've largely been under Mike Ashley, which is a club fighting at the bottom. So that's why, even though within 2 points, as against eight, there probably was more hope. There's also been £85 million spent on the team since then. Mm-hmm. Now, without being contradictory, there is a stylistic element that Newcastle fans have probably been brought up going back to Kevin Keegan as a player, of Peter Beardsley and Chris Waddle, and they like to see the football on the front foot. Steve Bruce might not be... Well, he's not somebody like Guardiola that carries a certain distinctive style with him, even like perhaps Graham Potter of Brighton. But he has stressed to us all recently that he wants the team to be more attack-minded. And yesterday was the first time that he's really done that. The victory buys him time. The fact that he took the shackles off the team a little bit more, and Alan Saint-Maximin had a good game, and the two young lads played well, and DeAndre Yedlin played as well, and the team looked quicker and more mobile and more purposeful. That will also keep the pressure on him. But there's two hard games coming up against Chelsea and Wolves, and as for the size of the backing from the support, there's still a big question mark against him. But yesterday is a start for him to move it in the right direction.
Hey, I'm Ryan Reynolds.
Recently, I asked Mint Mobile's legal team if big wireless companies are allowed to raise prices due to inflation. They said yes. And then when I asked if raising prices technically violates those onerous two-year contracts, they said, what the f*** are you talking about, you insane Hollywood ass?
So to recap, we're cutting the price of Mint Unlimited from $30 a month to just $15 a month. Give it a try at mintmobile.com/switch.
$45 up front for 3 months plus taxes and fees. Promo rate for new customers for limited time. Unlimited more than 40 gigabytes per month. Slows full terms at mintmobile.com.
Tired of ads interfering with your favorite sports podcasts? Good news. Ad-free listening is available on Amazon Music for all the music plus top podcasts included with your Prime membership. Stay ahead of the game by downloading the Amazon Music app for free. Or go to amazon.com/sportsadfree. That's amazon.com/sportsadfree to catch up on the latest episodes without the ads.
Now, Maurizio Pochettino says he's not worried about the sack despite Tottenham's poor form. Spurs lost 3-0 at Brighton on Saturday to compound a miserable week that also saw them thrash 7-2 by Bayern Munich in the Champions League. The club were also knocked out of the Carabao Cup on penalties by League Two Colchester last month. And when asked if he feared for his job, Pochettino said, "No, I am not worried. What worries me is life, not football." But Gregor, should Pochettino be worried?
For his job?
Yeah.
I don't think so, no.
No.
He's transformed that football club, and this is obviously the most difficult moment for him in his time there. But we've discussed there's many reasons for that, and they're not all his fault. In fact, very few of them are. I think the biggest thing that you can point at Pochettino about was kind of cultivating a bit of a negative atmosphere and questioning the future. His future at the club and the future of other players, but the future of the players who, you know, have either not been offered a contract or they are agitating for moves elsewhere, that's not really his fault. I think that sort of, they just didn't deal with that. They didn't deal with that scenario over the last 2 years, really. They either needed to move players on, sell them and replace them, or they had to give them new contracts. And they've done neither in several cases. So I don't think he should fear for his job, but it is quite alarming how much their form has fallen off the edge of a cliff, and how, you know, I think they ran 7.5 kilometres less than Brighton on Saturday, which is pretty alarming. And as we've discussed already, their pressing game is completely collapsed.
What does that suggest to you then, if they're not running as much? Is it that they're not trying? What does that mean?
It's not that they're not trying. Football's still overwhelmingly about psychology, you know? And these guys, they know their futures are very uncertain. Whether that's because they want to be at the club and they've not been offered contracts and they're sort of into their 30s, or whether that's because they want to move elsewhere and they've either been prevented from that happening in the last transfer window, or they want to do it in January, they want to do it after that. And there has been quite a lot said about this sort of, there's not been enough evolution of the squad. You know, I think there's 8 players left from Pochettino's first season. 7 of them started at the weekend. And when you compare that to most other clubs, and it's sort of, that's light and day. And there's only so long, you know, he's a very demanding coach. I think that's what the noise is coming out, or his demands are sort of getting wearying when you're not sure you're going to be part of the long-term project, but you're still being asked to do a heck of a lot every day in training and in terms of on a Saturday impressing as a unit. And their whole sort of success and ethos has been built on that sort of commitment and desire and emotion, you know, emotional ties and emotional sort of connection with the manager. And any sort of chink in that armoury is having a massive effect, I think.
And also, I mean, and I think all of that is summed up in Alderweireld. I mean, I think you see him.
Yeah.
I thought that, you know, we saw him, Gnabry sort of run around him like he wasn't there in the Bayern Munich game. We saw for the Brighton, was it the third Brighton goal, where I think he's literally just static. I mean, you know, this is a top quality defender, maybe not quite as good as he thinks he is, or his agent thinks he is, that, you know, he was going to get some mega million move to one of the top clubs. But he is a quality centre-half by any standard. And he, you know, we all know he's had the issue with contract and hanging out for that. And he just seems to be, yeah, to me, his last two games has summed up the problem of Spurs. He's playing way short of his potential. He Pochettino used the phrase, gave up about his team collectively at the end of the Bayern Munich game. And I don't see the fight in him. I'm not singling him out because, you know, he's been, you know, he deserves to be singled out. I just think he sums up the issue of bring together the issue of contract, of all the things that Gregor mentioned about. And I think the problem is it becomes someone else's problem. When you're in that position, you know, he knows that his chances are he might be leaving Spurs. So if they're having a very average season by their standards, is that ever going to be his problem to deal with? It's, yeah, you get to that stage where, well, you know, I want out of here. I'm probably going to get out of here. You know, and once you start sort of having that blurred focus, then at this level, I think it's very hard to perform.
But there are players, notably Aaron Ramsey, let's say, even James Milner, who we're going to talk about later on, who's out of contract in the summer, who you don't think, well, they're not playing to their maximum.
If I could just add on, I mean, one thing, I think Pochettino is a top draw manager, but I do think his attitude, I think, again, as Gregor said, it can be put in understandable and can be put in context, but I think it's been thoroughly unhelpful to the club. I mean, if I were Daniel, you know, I think blame for this predicament can be shared around. I think Pochettino is not innocent because, you know, I think his sort of niggly, yeah, the fact that he's advertised his disgruntlement since the start is, again, you know, that then creates an environment in which the players start to think, well, you know, he's almost giving you an excuse to perform less than your best. So I do think Pochettino, you know, we can put it in context, we can put it understandable, but also he was given a couple of hugely expensive signings. I'm not saying they were all going to be the answer to everything, but, you know, he has advertised his own unease, and that's undoubtedly a significant part of Spurs' problem.
I'd put Dier and Rose in that as well. It's almost like they might have missed the boat in getting one of these, kind of a big money move to a Manchester United or something like that. And now it's sort of, now they're off, they find themselves even out the team and not sure if they're going to get another deal and be part of the Spurs project. That has an effect on you psychologically. And Christian Eriksen, you know, he could be the next one. He was sure he was going to get a move to Spain or a bigger club in the summer. It's not happened. Is it going to happen?
From what you know of Maurizio Pochettino and Tottenham, Matt, do you think he can turn it around this season?
I think Henry wrote after the Bayern game, which I think is right, is that there's a fork in the road here, and I'm not saying he's going to sort of recommit for the next 3 years, 5 years, but I think he needs to have a long, hard think about where he wants to be this time next year. And if that's leaving Spurs, then that is going to become very, very obvious to everyone in the club, and is going to mean that they don't turn this around very easily or very quickly. So he has got a huge decision to make there. I mean, it would be pretty understandable if he's looking at the next move. I think, you know, ultimately Tottenham probably have gone more or less, you know, they could win a domestic cup, but they're not going to win the title in the next couple of years. They've got to a Champions League final, which was, you know, thrilling, but again, it's going to be extremely hard to replicate that. So you can understand if he's looking at his next move. But if he is looking at his next move and his mind is already sort of 1 foot out of Tottenham, then I suspect this is going to be a pretty pretty bumpy campaign.
OK, it's time to look back over the EFL weekend and in particular on the Championship. But Gregor, if we focus on the result between Millwall and Leeds, Millwall went into this game with caretaker manager Adam Barrett in charge. That's after Neil Harris resigned on Thursday after 4 years in charge. It's been a difficult season for Millwall. Their results and their performances not up to scratch, but somehow they come away with a win over Leeds, who everyone is expecting to get promoted.
Neil Harris is, you know, he's an absolute legend at that club. Mm. He's a great guy, got a lot of respect in the game. Had a great 4 years, you know. They've got two FA Cup quarterfinals, I believe, two Wembley finals, and the last of which they won promotion from League One. And he's, you know, their all-time scorer. He's got a great standing at that club, so it kind of felt like to keep that standing at the club, they sort of came to an agreement that maybe it's time for him to step aside. But it was an emotional day, I think, and obviously the players really love him. And it did help that Leeds had a man sent off after 14 minutes. And it was kind of, even then, same old story for Leeds. I feel like every week we're saying, yeah, Leeds dominated the ball. They had about 70% possession, even with 10 men. I think even Bielsa's getting bored. I saw a quote of his that said, "Always we're trying to explain why what we want doesn't happen. It impacts the tolerance of the people who are listening." So he's kind of saying, I'm getting sick of saying this same thing every week. You know, we're hammering teams really, but just can't find the back of the net.
Okay, well, that's the Leeds situation. We have to talk about Stoke, because unbelievably, and probably not many would have predicted them going to Swansea, who were the league leaders at the time, and winning 2-1. It was a late goal as well from Scott Hogan that sealed the points for Stoke. And that was after a week of turmoil where everyone was expecting Nathan Jones to get the sack. Then he comes out and says the board pretty much have given him their backing. Do you think, first of all, other sides should take inspiration from Stoke in the way that they've handled this situation and not actually dismissing a manager when things aren't going well, but it's still very early in the season?
Yeah, I'd love to say yes, but I mean, we're living in cloud cuckoo land then, really. he still might go. Let's not make any mistake about that. It's a huge win for them. I mean, they went a goal behind after 52 seconds as well. So really, I'm sure the attitudes weren't great then. But the scenes afterwards as well of celebration, you know, it's massive for them after, I think it was a 10 games without a win. And yes, I'd love to see him succeed first and foremost, because he doesn't turn into a bad manager because of this spell. He had three great years at Luton. And the thing that is unusual about this is that he's been given this time. But if he's given the time and he turns it around, then yeah, who knows? Maybe it will make one or two chairmen just sort of think, we've got a guy here who we know is very capable and sort of committed and a talented coach. Just give him that wee bit longer to turn things around, and I hope he does.
Yeah, he's certainly ridden the storm at the moment. But as you say, perhaps they're only as good as their next game, and it's Fulham next as well. So it won't be an easy one for them to come back to after the international break. Do you think the international break in some ways comes at a bad time then for Nathan Jones and Stoke?
No, I wouldn't say that. I think, you know, just getting that sort of monkey off their back and just lifting the mood a bit at the Bet365. And, you know, if they had lost that, it wouldn't have been all that surprising to see him getting the sack, which would have given them a bit of time to bring someone else in over the international break. But as it is, they go into that with their sort of chins raised a little bit. And look, they've still on paper, they've got one of the best squads in the division. That's what's been so perplexing about it all. Mm. So there's no reason why they cannot look upwards now.
Well, it is that first win then for Stoke that they have picked up this season after winning at Swansea. They do remain bottom of the Championship, but a crucial 3 points for them after, 11 games, they picked up that first win of the season. OK, well, that is it for now. Many thanks to our guests today, Matt Dickinson, Paul Hurst and Martin Hardy as well.
Remember, you can subscribe to The Times and The Sunday Times to enjoy award-winning journalism online and on your smartphone or tablet.
It is just £1 a week for an 8-week trial. Search The Times subscription for more information and we'll be back on Thursday.
The Game is brought to you by The Times. For more information and more podcasts from The Times, head to thetimes.co.uk.
Even on a budget, quality is non-negotiable. That's why Quince is the place to score high-end essentials at 50 to 80% less than similar brands. Get your hands on buttery soft cashmere sweaters from just $60, Italian leather jackets, and so much more. And the best part about Quince, they exclusively partner with factories committed to safe, ethical, and responsible manufacturing. Elevate your style without the elevated price tag with Quince. Go to quince.com/upgrade for free shipping and 365-day returns.
Tired of ads interfering with your favorite sports podcasts? Good news. Ad-free listening is available on Amazon Music for all the music plus top podcasts included with your Prime membership. Stay ahead of the game by downloading the Amazon Music app for free. Or go to amazon.com/sportsadfree. That's amazon.com/sportsadfree to catch up on the latest episodes without the ads.